Hi, everyone. This is Jaime Alejandro with the Arts Calling podcast, the place where I showcase hardworking independent creatives in the literary, visual, and performing arts. Before I get to our guest, I do have a small favor to ask of you. If you have enjoyed the conversations we've shared over the last few years on the show, it would really make a difference if you could rate and review Arts Calling on whatever platform you are listening. Also, if you like this or any previous episode, do me a favor and share it with someone, just one person. That alone would help out tremendously. Otherwise, I already can't thank you enough for being here and sharing your time with me. So here goes. Today, I am delighted to be Arts Calling author Lee Upton. Let me tell you about our guest. Lee Upton's comic novel, Tabitha Get Up, is forthcoming in May 2024. Another novel, A Literary Mystery, will be out in May 2025. Her books include her seventh collection of poetry, The Day Every Day Is, from Saturnalia Books, two short story collections, a novella, four books of literary criticism, and an essay collection. Her poetry has appeared in The New Yorker, Poetry, and Southern Review, as well as three editions of Best American Poetry. She is the recipient of the Pushcart Prize, the National Poetry Series Award, Poetry Society of America Awards, the Miami University Novella Prize, the Open Book Award, the Saturnalia Book Prize, and other honors. And folks, I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as Lee and I did. This was a great chat. We covered not only her latest upcoming work, but the idea of the mystery as a foundation for storytelling. We spoke about how every writer is something of a biographer, experimenting with form, and so, so much more. Once again, thank you so much, Lee, for your time. And without further delay, let's give Lee a call. Hi, good morning, Lee. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. I'm especially happy now that we get to chat. I've been reading your book, and it's been such a wonderful time that I just wanted to pick your brain and make sure that we can cover as much as we can so we can tell folks about it. But before we talk about your latest work, though, I'd like to start at the beginning and maybe ask you a few things about where you're from. So maybe we can start with where you're at these days.
Okay. Well, for about the past 35 years, I've been living in Eastern Pennsylvania, but I'm actually from Fowler, Michigan. I grew up on a 140-acre farm there. And then later I would move to Lansing, Michigan, go to Michigan State University, then to Massachusetts, and then later to Binghamton, New York for graduate school. And then I've settled here. I've taught at Lafayette College here in Easton for 35 years. And, you know, I stepped away from teaching. I'm now right full time.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful to hear. So when you were younger, do you recall what works inspired you or how you began that creative spark? I know that people have a lot of ways into this. And ultimately, it's I don't know, it could have been an educator or a book that really stuck with you.
Well, my mother, and she would give me a lot of Shakespeare. And she tells the story that when I was a little kid, she'd find me in the basement acting out Shakespeare. And I wouldn't know even what the words meant, but I must have, you know, thought it was of interest. And so I wrote, you know, pretty early, but I was particularly interested in poets, but I thought poetry was written by dead people. I didn't understand that actual living people wrote this. And then, you know, I wrote a lot, probably in high school was the only period when I wrote a bit less during those travails of those years. And then when I was an undergraduate, I rediscovered poetry again and fiction again and started writing. And I lived in a house with these wonderful people who were writers as well, and who are still friends and who I cherish. And I think being among other writers was really useful to me. I think that's so important. So I invested a great deal in poetry, then in graduate school. I began writing about other poets too, and I tended to write about poets who I thought were misread or, you know, misunderstood. And at the same time, I was still writing fiction, you know, so I just kept going on, writing more and more. I love writing, and I'm almost an obsessive writer. I write much more than I would ever even wish to publish. I like to experiment and all. So this new novel was really exciting for me.
Oh,
thank you for reading it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm thrilled about getting to ask you in particular about the format of it. And maybe we can just talk about the novel, because I think it's a good place that intertwines a lot of what I was going to ask you. And I feel like it might be appropriate. But one of my favorite things about it, of course, was Tabitha. And the name of the novel is Tabitha, Get Up. And so I wanted to ask you about the wonderful forms that you use in this piece. It's so curious in the way that it's constructed. And I wanted to ask you how you find this vessel for such a character and have those things aligned so well. I feel like Tabitha, in this form of looking at the world, is very much, you have text messages, you have these conversations over the phone, you have so much in so many different forms, but it fits within her worldview, within her perspective. And so I wanted to ask you how you arrive at that, because it's such a wonderful form and device for her.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for reading it so carefully. Well, there's an actual origin story for the novel. I wrote a long short story, which was a failure. too much was going on in the short story, but it's been a very fortunate short story for me, because Tabitha came out of it, as well as the another novel that's coming out next year, which is a literary mystery. So the original short story, Tabitha came out of it because at the end of the short story, there was an email, and the email was from a biographer like Tabitha, who wrote to her publisher, like I have Tabitha do, but she was a very obnoxious person. This person in the short story was very obnoxious, but I loved the rhythms of her voice. Mm-hmm. I loved them. And I started to write a novel with her. And then I realized I can't spend 300 pages with this woman. I just can't. She's so graspy and greedy and shallow. And I thought, she's fun and she's got a lot of energy, but do I want to live with her? And so I thought about her more, and that's how I created Tabitha. I kind of took some of that energy and that wish, almost that desperate wish for a job to make some money, and then put it in a kind of other vessel. The reason I think why this novel, unlike, you know, most of my other work, is in segments, in a sense, is because they're notes. Tabitha is a very vulnerable person in some ways, and a very courageous person, but she's trying to keep herself from, you know, descending into sadness. So she writes notes to herself, and she tries to document her own experiences continually. So the form came about partly because of that email. So once I started with an email, I thought, oh, this is really a nice format. And I've talked to friends who talk about regretting that, you know, that writing fiction involves a world where people text, people can always be in communication with each other. Mm-hmm. But I kind of love that for a novel, because it just allows for more miscommunication. And so much of life is about being wrong. And so that was how I created this character, first through that sort of galloping, insistent voice. I had such fun with it, and how she doesn't have a kind of filter. And so I made her too out of people I care for, who I think are kind of priceless. So I combined a number of people.
Yeah. And I thought it was so brilliantly done that I'm still thinking about, in particular, the way that the forms revealed her behaviors, her true natures, I think, because there was a lot of push and pull, but you used those forms. And in particular, it did feel like sort of like a steamrolling train coming at you. But there was also this moment that I really liked where she's talking to her publisher and she's very nice. But then in the second part of that scene, she's very much like, here's everything that I've done wrong, or here's everything that I've worried about. And so there was this constant sort of push and pull with her emotionally. And I think we could empathize with her a lot more. And even something, you know, for me that I just thought was so wonderful was like, she was just acknowledging, maybe I should get a job, you know, maybe I should go back to the credit report company or the last place that she had worked. And I just thought that was so brilliantly done. But if we could look at the idea of biographers and why biographers, because there's an interesting quest there. Definitely something that we could talk about.
Yeah, I am very interested in biographers. You know, I just think that they lead lives of self-sacrifice. I have to think that because, you know, I think, you know, I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, but they will know everything about another person. So in some ways, biographers, they're so necessary for us to think about how people sculpt a life. And biographers, I think, I could imagine that they know far more than they tell us, and they may sometimes identify with their subjects in a way that becomes protective or obsessive. I have at least one short story about a biographer as well. I think some of it draws from, you know, the way I was able to get through college and afford it was I worked for the Capital newspaper in Lansing, Michigan. I wasn't on staff. I was a freelance writer, which meant that and to pay my rent, I'd have to do so many stories. And to pay my tuition, I had to do so many stories. But that kind of work, they had me working generally with the entertainment portion of the paper. So I was, you know, this, you know, 20 years old or whatever, but I got to interview Frank Sinatra Jr. and, you know, Wolfman Jack and Lynn Anderson. And I kind of had to do a little bit of almost biography work to research people. And also I had what biographers have, that is an excuse to ask questions and to find out, you know, things about people. And sometimes it would be very harrowing. I remember once just being told, you are very nosy. You know, and I remember being told, you look like a high school kid. Why would I spend time, you know, my time with you? And so I think of biographers, that was my kind of slim entry into finding out about people's lives. And it's never left me, that my sense of thinking about what that might be. I've known a few biographers and I've been told, oh, you should do biographies. It takes 10 years at least. And I'm thinking, gosh, that's a lot of chunk of life to give to another this personality or whatever. But I think in a way, we're all biographers. We're continually making up stories, trying to figure out, you know, what's happening, not just with ourselves, of course, but with our friends, with family members. So I think that biographical impulse is deep within many of us. Biographers take it much, much further. I also know that biographers live lives that are kind of on the edge. Because suddenly permission can be withdrawn by executors. And I know of at least one case where material was in, you know, in proof stage and permission was withdrawn. And so I have just a real interest in them. And I think of it makes sense that Tabitha would be a biographer, given she's a ruminator and trying to figure out her own life, but we learn about other lives, our own lives, I think, through others. And also, I think she's genuinely curious about people, although she always wishes people did more forbidden things. People are a little too normal for her.
Yeah, and that was something that really dovetails well with this notion of identity and really what's underneath the surface. I think that she's always looking for a deeper chapter, a deeper layer, but it also preserves herself. It helps her protect herself from, you know, whatever it is, that loneliness, as you said. I mean, there was a beautiful passage, and it was about halfway through the book where you mention her sort of looking over to her loneliness in some way. And I just thought that was so heartbreaking because it was just a peak, you know, before the dam really broke. And I was like, oh, something's coming. It's, you know, it definitely broke my heart a little bit, which is so wonderful.
Thank you.
As you continue the work to bring these people together, who were the characters who came after? Because of course you had Tabitha first, but who else started making their way into the creation of this world?
You know, Piper Fields, who is the children's book author, who's also an author of erotica with a kind of a fanatical cult following. I'm trying to think, I tried to write a short story about Piper Fields, and it didn't quite gel. So she's, was moving around in my consciousness a bit. I was very fond of writing Tabitha's mother, who's close to 90, who is the most self-absorbed, inflated personality, but I loved her. And I know that she's insulting. I know that she, you know, pushes a great deal onto her daughter, but in some ways, psychologically, she's an easy mother to have for an adult daughter. I mean, you're never going to change a parent anyway, especially one near 90, but there's something about her, she never needs anything. She needs Tabitha to do little, you know, errands for her and to create these spice jars that, you know, are for a charity. But she never believes she'll ever die. She has no pity for others, but in a way she's not self-pitying. She's too self-glorifying. So Tabitha doesn't have to kind of take care of her or worry too much about her. Mm. And also Tabitha has that wonderful nephew, Leon. Now, I have wonderful nephews and nieces. My brother married very young, and they're, you know, 14 years between us. So, and he had children, he and his wife, very young. So my nieces and nephews, some of them are, you know, the ages are relatively closer than one might expect. Mm-hmm. But I thought Leon as a character it is just an absolute support for her. He's actually 1 year older, her nephew. And as children, they really grew up together. They were really, really feral. To create her, the grandmother, Maddie, came in a bit later because I thought Tabitha has to have someone who helped raise her, given her mother's all-inclusive, self-focus. And so I gave her this interesting grandmother who really likes Sylvia Plath and feels she understands Sylvia Plath, but helps Tabitha and Leon as children. I mean, they were really neglected. They had burrs in their hair, but because they were neglected, in some ways that let them be original people without, you know, the pressure of adult consciousness continually telling them how to feel, how to think, how to behave, how to sit, how to eat. So there's something about the two characters where there's real deep love between them and also a deep need for freedom, but real problems outside one another. So those were some of the characters who came in gradually. And I will say this, some of the work I've done, it's, you know, I always love writing, but sometimes it's really difficult for me. Some of the manuscripts, I really suffer. I never suffered with this book. I needed the book very much. At the time that I wrote it, a family member was going through a terrible illness. He's doing well now, but, you know, with radiation, chemotherapy, there was COVID at the same time, which makes, you know, medical treatment all the more difficult. And so I actually told myself to write a comic novel to give a kind of elevation, uplift, to keep myself feeling stronger. And so the joy in that novel, being in that world, was really helpful to me. I also, you know, because of COVID, I couldn't go out to bars or restaurants. So I gave Tabitha the world's best bar and lots of little restaurants and cafes, and she could walk around in the park. So the things that were kind of denied all of us during that period, I gave her. And it was really helpful to me to keep me feeling that I could deal with some of the real difficulties and uncertainties and but at the same time I was witnessing such incredible bravery of a family member, you know, every day. And so I'd be within that world, and then, you know, when I could, I'd write the novel. And it sounds so weird, but I laughed all through the novel. I'm like a comedian. Everyone says, don't laugh at your own jokes. I was always laughing, you know, but the people in the house would say, stop, I can't concentrate. You're laughing so much. So I'm so glad that you found it funny. That's always my fear, that people will read it and just, you know, feel blankly toward it, not have any response whatsoever. So it was, Tabitha, I think, is a character who has a very precise form of intelligence that, and at the same time, you know, it's funny. It's peculiar enough to be funny, I hope.
Absolutely. And I will say the jokes landed, so you won't be laughing alone. Now, that's something beautiful to hear, because I didn't connect the dots on that until you just shared that. And it's so pleasing to hear. And of course, you know, I'm glad to hear about your relative doing better, because in those moments of hardship, I can imagine that the best thing that one can have is an outlet to go to a sense of escapism. But in return, you get a manuscript that is full of energy and joy, but also mishaps and all kinds of wild stuff happening, which, you know, definitely masks some of the true origins of the piece. But one of the great takeaways for me was I noticed that since you have another novel coming out, Wrongful, it is a mystery, but I realized that there were some elements of mystery in this piece too. She was piecing together a lot of these two lives, and I'm curious what the connective tissue is between these two works, because they were written fairly close to each other, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they both come from the same short story. Wrongful, that novel, it's about a literary festival. There are two of them, 10 years apart, and in the first one, something happens to the main speaker, and a young woman who had gone to the festival then 10 years later goes back to the festival to try to figure out what really happened to the woman. And so it's it has its comic moments. There's one moment where the primary character says that, you know, and I love poetry readings, but she doesn't. And she says it's like being scolded by someone with hiccups, you know, for the poetry reading. But most of it is about, it's a lot about kind of how can we know what's true or not. And so it's called Wrongful because, you know, as you say, with mysteries and mysteries in Tabitha, you're always getting things wrong, and mysteries depend on fooling the reader in some ways. So that's what's happening in Wrongful, the novel coming out next year. It's I'll just mention briefly, it does have a biographical basis. When I was about 18 or so, I took a bus. I'd seen a flyer. I went to a community college, and there was a flyer about a poetry conference. I thought, oh, I love poetry. I knew nothing about contemporary poetry. So I went to it, and it was quite life-changing to be there. So one of the characters, I suppose, draws from that sense of idealism and surprise there. But it is a mystery. And I think, Tabitha, you're right, and thank you for pointing that out. It is a mystery about who one of the characters is, and is she telling the truth or not? And there are multiple lies involved. And it takes a while, but Tabitha is actually very, in some situations, is good at ferreting out truth. So it was kind of the joy of a mystery. It's also partly Given that the kind of focus of desire is an actor, actors are always kind of celebrities of that sort, are mysterious to us, and we don't quite know who they are. And so we're always trying to figure out their identity in some ways too. So an actor is a mystery. The other character is a mystery as well too. So I think it also links up with a sense of identity, like who is Tabitha, who is Leon, and this sense of what's worthwhile in life, what are we staying with. And I think, you know, I haven't mentioned much about the actor, Brent Vintner, who I think is a mystery too. Mm-hmm. And part of the mystery for Tabitha is why would he be someone who allows her to write a biography, because she's so used to people telling her no. And so it's partly a mystery about him, who he is. And then, you know, maybe later in the novel, she discovers something about his past that seemingly hardly anyone knew and will know. And so I think, you know, I think I have a lovely friend, Kate Reculia. I remember once she visited a class of mine, and she said that, you know, all writing is a kind of mystery story. And I think that's true, that, you know, so much is about unpeeling or revealing, because that echoes the way our lives work. And it's also, I think, the way, you know, love between people works is like, I know I'll never get to the end of my husband. There's always more to be discovered, you know, some more to be found out. And I think it's true with Tabitha, in a sense of, you know, she's a 50-year-old woman, and so many kind of novels that I love are about 20-year-old women or 30-year-old women. Mm-hmm. There are fewer about 40-year-old women. Somehow 40-year-old women and men, they get the shaft. But, you know, because I think because we're so interested in how people navigate into adulthood and into a fuller life, or the courtship rituals of that period. But I thought making her a 50-year-old woman was really fun, because she then has a past behind her, and there are fewer books that deal with 50-year-olds. You know, I remember being, you know, a little tiny kid and looking at an eighth grader and thinking, oh, they have life figured out. You know, there's a sense that whatever age you're at, there's a sense that those older understand more. But I think life at every juncture hands you so many new problems and new possibilities. The old answers don't work anymore. So I like the idea of her being an older woman, and Brent Vintner being a younger fellow, and how in some ways those year markers are less important than something deeper within each of those characters.
Right. And I'm glad you bring that up, because throughout the piece, I was wondering this idea of age. And of course, you're able to represent her so beautifully, because she's funny. She's erratic. She's a real fully fleshed out human being. But at the same time, I was always left curious with the questions of, like, we're making comparisons here at the same time. You know, you have Tinker Flats, you know, who's walking around with her boots, and there's this distance, and you're still identifying those gaps. But at the same time, it is one of those things that just makes you so happy to see somebody, you know, no matter what their age is, going through certain struggles and facing them head on. And I think that was her triumph in many respects. But I don't mean to digress, but I love that you have tremendous experience across various forms, various genres, and you do criticism as well, as you mentioned. And there's so much here that I imagine was helped forward by your use of many forms across your artistic or, you know, creative output. And I'm curious, if we could begin with criticism, what has that done to your writing, and how do you incorporate that into the work that you're bringing out now?
Well, I think that, you know, when I think about it, and I guess it goes back to biography, the first book of criticism I wrote grew out of my dissertation. And I would take the bus into New York City and to the Berg Collection. The writer I wrote on was named Jean Garrigue. She was a really incredibly, you know, beautiful writer. But her reputation had, she sort of disappeared after her death in the 70s. I'd gone to a library book sale. It was the last day of the sale. I picked her book up for 5 cents, I think. It was basically for nothing. And on the back of the book were blurbs by Marianne Moore and Robert Lowell. And I thought, oh, this must be interesting. And then I kind of caught the voice. I kept reading her and thinking, oh, this is affecting my own work and I'd like to know more about her. So I'd go to the Berg and I'd read all her papers like a biographer would. And there was so much because she was almost a graphomaniac with letters. She wrote long letters almost every day. And so I would work them, you know, there were biographers there with their long, you know, poster board of, you know, years and kind of connecting years and dates. So I think that work in looking at, you know, people's lives and seeing how they were pieced together, but also realizing I can never get to the end of them. I mean, it would be, I mean, you would, because she wrote every day, you'd be reading one for the rest of your life. I think that that sort of looking at a life piecemeal was also contributing in some ways to the form, that our lives are somewhat piecemeal, particularly with texts and emails and all. So I think that the critical work also, you know, when I looked into these, I saw a lot of private letters, and there's often like private letters between people who are in love with each other, but are also keeping secrets from each other. That's what you find out as a, when you're doing any work that's biographical, you see that's happening. And so a lot of the, when I wrote about each of the writers I wrote about, I didn't include much biographical material, although I certainly could have, particularly in the case of the first book. So there's a lot of, you know, deciding what to ignore and what to put in. So I think that that would in some ways inform the novel writing as well too. Mm-hmm. I think also though, it was very hard for me to learn how to write fiction. It almost reversed long-term habits with poetry. I always wrote some fiction, but I tended to write monologues, you know, one voice primarily. The idea of orchestrating multiple voices was very, very hard for me. And it took me a long time of trying and failing. It was hard for me to imagine how to get a character out of a chair into a window or to, you know, the idea of cause and effect, because I'd worked so hard with poetry. And with poetry, I always think of poetry as kind of like a whirlpool, like there's this concentrated power and it draws you in. Whereas fiction, it may have whirlpools within it, but generally there's that forward movement and there's consequences and cause and effect, at least in the sort of fiction I write and love perhaps the most. And so, you know, when I think of a fiction, you want people to turn the page, but in poetry often you want them to stay on the page and read the poem again and live in the poem and to slow down. And I don't mean that that happens with all fiction, that you want to move ahead, but there is that sense of you want people to think, what's next? What happens next? You know, who is going to suffer? And it's a kind of, you're putting your characters through a test in a way. So for me to learn to write fiction after principally writing poetry for so many years and letting my ear lead me, you know, mm-hmm. rather than scenic events, even listening in a different way, I had to kind of cantilever my ears in a different way, because fiction needs its dull spots. It needs its kind of quiet spots. Whereas poetry, even a long poem, there's that intensification where everything counts, that the commas count, the white space counts. And, you know, the reader is usually bringing a kind of different mental habit to the poem than to the fiction. And I care deeply about poetry. It's my sustaining art. But fiction I care about just as well. Somewhat of a, you know, I move among them. But poetry came almost naturally to me, focusing on images, letting my ear lead me to the next line, the kind of self-trust of poetry, the kind of you know, musicality. Fiction has its musicality, it has its voice, its energy as well too, but there's also things happen scenically and they connect. Even if you're moving backwards in time, you know, you want them to connect. And maybe the reason why Tabitha Get Up didn't give me as much trouble as other novels, and you know, I've written a novella and short stories as well, is because it had that, it almost has stanza breaks like a poem, because it is created in portions. And so I learned I don't work, like as in poetry, you don't really worry about transitions. You trust the reader to make that leap and make that jump. So I think poetry really helped me learn how to write that particular kind of, in that particular kind of form. It seemed a little more natural. Whereas the novel Wrongful, you know, it moves at first with multiple characters talking, interacting. Then there's a middle section of, you know, a primary character, and we're in her consciousness. Then it ends with multiple characters talking. So it has, you know, very different kind of form there that you can, you know, even see visually.
Right. And I have to say, I've read some of your poetry. In particular, the last one I read was The Reprieve, which was a poem that, like, one of the first ones that came up on Google when I found it. And I said, this is really the epitome of stillness. And then there's that lift. And it was just a delightful poem. So I'm going to put it in the episode description so folks can check it out. But I'm also thinking that you probably still have that Shakespeare DNA. I mean, how can one compete with the soliloquy and think, oh, maybe there's... This is the way to do it. This is the way to write anything and everything. It's the perfect vessel. Now, I got a couple of questions to be mindful of your time here, but you mentioned something in another interview that I wanted to check in with you on. There was a book, a novella that you wrote called The Guide to the Flying Island. And you mentioned something about feeling like you might have to abandon this project. And I wonder if you could share some thoughts about what led you to get it out into the world and see it through.
More often what I've done is I've transformed them. I can think of several short stories I've worked on for years, and maybe because I've worked on them for years, they're never gonna, you know, I just got to abandon them. But it's almost as if I know too much about them. I've tried too much. There's a certain amount of not knowing that I think really works for me, so that even the book, as I'm writing it, is kind of mystery. Usually I don't know exactly where I'm going, and then the ending will really surprise me. I do have one story called The Humor Writing Class, and that where I wrote to an ending, and I told myself I'm going to write a story, and the last line of the story is going to be, "There were squirrels." And I wrote to that, and it was really fun and all. But I think that so often, rather than totally abandoning a story, or usually it's a novel, I'll get up to 60,000 words and I think, oh, this is working and all. And then I'll say, see, no, it's just not. And I have to be very careful, because with The Guide to the Flying Island, I think, you know, probably from that interview you saw, I was ready. I assumed I'd have to abandon it. Like a week before I got the acceptance, I thought, I just didn't have enough self-confidence in my fiction. And I thought, no, this is such a strange novella. Maybe I can shorten it, make it a short story. I can do something else with it. And thank God I didn't, and all. But I have I have two collections of short stories, and in the one collection, I think it's the Tao of Humiliation, there are three stories in that, all of them were pulled from one novel manuscript. So I took a novel manuscript I've written. It was over 300 pages, so that's a lot of love and time and effort and thinking. And I pulled them out and then remade them so that they could still live. I felt it, I was still learning so much about how to make a novel that I just felt it's too baggy, too much is going on. I think a problem for many writers when you're first working with a novel is you get too complex and too much is happening because you don't yet know how to slow down and eke out a scene. You don't know how to relax yet with it. But I loved the characters and all, so I just made them into something else. I turned them into short stories, their lives, and then they seemed to work for me, and now they live, but in another format.
Oh, wonderful. There's a couple of things that I'm thinking of asking you here, because you've done this for a while. You know various forms, and I think that for me, I'm struggling with this idea of what it means to have a life well lived as a writer, as a creative person. And I'd like to make these moments a little bit more pointed for the audience, or perhaps young listeners who might be interested in finding a way to bring this creative work into the world without losing their sense of well-being, without losing, you know, a path toward a good quality of life. And I'm curious if you can share some thoughts about what kind of life did you craft for yourself that allows for writing and for this kind of creative output that you've had in the world?
This has been a wonderful interview. I mean, just your questions are so wonderful and thoughtful. And I would say that's something that I encounter day to day. Like I taught for a long time. I'm not teaching anymore, so I'm in this wonderful position. But I know earlier in my life, you know, it was difficult. So some of it was some little tricks I had because I love to write so much. Like I always told myself, Susan Sontag was once asked about attending an event and she was told it'll be boring. And I remember she said something like, well, that's why it will be interesting. So I always felt even when you're captured in some boring situation, some, you know, boring event that you have to go to in order to be part of the world, you can always have your little notebook, or you can just look at people and watch people and be taking notes. Another thing that you can do is, you know, find the little times in your life. Like I remember I used to write a lot on the bus, for instance. I used to have this terrible, terrible job at a credit agency. God, I don't know why they didn't fire me, but I was just drinking coffee all day to stay awake, and I was a typist for part of the time, and what I would do is I would just always have my notepad there. And I think sometimes you have to be a little tricky because you have to make money, you have to have a job, but you have to find interstices in your life where that will work. I know when my children were young, my youngest child, what I did that really helped a lot was one day a week, I lived in an apartment building, and there was an older woman in the apartment building who was very lonely, and she would come in. I was still in the apartment, but she would come in and play with the baby, you know, rolling ball back and forth. And so those 2 hours were great. And then I wasn't worried because I was still right there in another room and could hear them playing. And that gave her some happiness too. Our second daughter has her name as a middle name. We're so grateful to her. So sometimes, you know, finding someone who, you know, if you have extra obligations, if you're a parent or whatever, finding a little extra help, you know, can be wonderful. Something else too is I really believe in guilt-free naps. I mean, writing, it is hard on the brain. It's not ditch digging or anything, but it's hard on your brain. And somehow, if you can take naps, and before bed too, I do this. I always tell myself to think of a problem in the writing. So I think, you know, kind of using whatever moments you can are really helpful. And then I suppose keeping some of the work secret, because it's so easy to talk away from work. Another thing you can always do too is find other people who care about writing. That's really important. So you can, some, we got a little bit of the cats here. you know, someone who cares about writing, so you're not alone with it. If I'd started, you know, in more recent years, you know, I started so long ago, but I would, you know, be probably in an online group or whatever, and I would be, the internet has opened up so much because you can hear so many readings, there's so many interviews. So to feel, if you're a young writer, it'd be so important to know you're part of this ongoing world, that this culture, and it's a worldwide culture of people writing. And also, you know, I think my eyes were opened when I was told, you know, to write like, you know, your family does. Your family, you know, my mother couldn't go to eighth grade. My father couldn't go to high school. You know, they had to work. They had to get out and support the family. And so their speech habits, you know, when I was first writing, my speech habits were a little different too. And so I would use those. And to, I think, honor the world you came from and never think it's boring or not worth falling in love with. And that your early life, you know, that's what people always say, that's what high school was for, you know, all that humiliation. You get your revenge as a writer because you use all of that. And I think that my early experiences of interviewing actors and you know, trying to get through college and trying to get a job. I mean, there's a point in Tabitha where she's downcast because she tries to interview to get a job as a waitress and they won't even let her fill out an application. That happened to me. So, and I remember being at the time thinking it's kind of humiliating, but also funny. And I think that, you know, realizing, you know, that your one life you have, if you want to be a writer, you have already discovered this art form that is so giving and generous to your spirit and to others, that you're already fortunate if you've discovered it.
Oh my goodness, Lee. Thank you so much. That was actually kind of a master class in perspective. I feel like that's exactly what I needed to hear, what, you know, a lot of people getting started need to hear. But I have one more question, because I think I'm going to make this an official mandate of the podcast. You have to introduce your cat now. Anytime I see a cat, your cat has to be introduced, because I mean, I want to be friends with your cat. I'm just saying.
Well, this is Chrissy, and he's a very good boy. And I would love to introduce you to, but I can't. We have a rabbit. A rabbit turned up on our driveway. It's so sad. Someone had abandoned this baby pet rabbit.
Oh.
And he's, you know, he was exhausted, dehydrated. So I don't know what we got, brought the rabbit in, and then we posted that we found a rabbit and no one came forward. And I didn't know how to take care of a rabbit. And I emailed friends. No one wanted the rabbit. But pretty soon we were in love with the rabbit. And he's a house rabbit, but he has his own room upstairs because of this guy.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I don't think some people have their cats and rabbits get along, but this guy, he's a little mischief maker, so I wouldn't trust him in the same room with the rabbit. But I'm glad you get to meet him. Do you have a pet?
I do. I have two cats, and they are ridiculous, and they are one of the best parts of my life. So I'm certainly a fan of cats. I want them with me all the time, and they're great editors. They help me remember that nothing is as important as a good guilt-free nap, as you said. That's brilliant.
Yeah. Well, that's it. And then Tabitha, get up. Tabitha at one point says that, you know, for a single woman, cats are a matter of survival.
Oh.
So yeah. She loves her cats too, although they're not always nice to her at first.
Oh, yeah. Goodness. Yeah. Well, Lee, it's been such a wonderful time talking with you. I know that we've just scratched the surface with, you know, the novel and with your trajectory, which has been just phenomenal. But I just want to thank you so much, because this is a really funny and witty and so surprising piece of work that I'm thoroughly impressed. And I'm just a huge fan of your fiction and your poetry. So I just can't wait to read your next work. And hopefully down the road, I can ask you more questions about your libretto and more poetry and all of the other forms that you've tackled, because this is just such a guilt-free way to look at creativity and just reaching for what is interesting, for what you love. And I know that you're just a well of resource that I'd love to chat with you down the road if you'd like. When the next one comes out, if you like.
Oh, I would love that. And thank you for these beautiful, sensitive questions. And it's been a joy to talk with you. And I wish you great good fortune. Anyone who talks with you is very lucky.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That means a lot, Lee. But I will let you enjoy your Sunday. And I hope we get to chat real soon. But again, congrats on the work. This is a wonderful, wonderful piece. Tabitha, Get Up. And now it's going to be available in May from Sagging Meniscus. Is that right?
Yeah, it's pretty much available May 22nd. It's coming out, and it's pretty much available anywhere now. Amazon doesn't have the cover, but it has the cover for the Kindle edition. So maybe even today they'll pop the cover on, but every other site has the cover. So they can get it at, bookshop.org or Estuesum, or it's everywhere now.
Wonderful. Well, I'll be sure to include all the links in the episode description so folks can check it out. But again, Lee, what a pleasure and what a great time this has been. So I hope you enjoy your Sunday, and I'll talk to you real soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye, Chrissy. Take care. Be good. Bye.
Bye.